Soon going to be going on retreat for a 3-month period, and I just wondered whether anybody had any topics or suggestions for this, or any burning issues which you really need to have sorted out, that I can possibly attempt to say a few words on this evening.
Do you have an equal amount of suffering and happiness in life?
Me personally?
No, everyone. Because I'm sure I heard one of the talks say that it did, and I just can't believe it.
No, I don't think so. No. I think it varies.
What's that?
It varies.
No, I'm sure. I think I heard one of them once say that, and I couldn't see it.
What it may have been saying is that one of the one of the things in Buddhist theory or Buddhist cosmology is that there are various realms of existence, and that in the heavenly realms you've got lots of happiness, and in the lower realms you have lots of suffering, and in the human realm you tend to have a balance of suffering and pleasure. So that's why it's the ideal place for practice. Doesn't necessarily mean, of course, it's completely equal, but just that generally speaking in your life you have some suffering and some pleasure. It's not exclusively one or the other. Yeah. Well, that was an easy one.
Hey, I've got a question about reflecting on, through science we came to see the planet is evolving. We see the evolution of life, and there is so much evidence. But I've been wondering about the ancient India at the time of Buddha, and the models. It appears to me that they did see the changes, but it wasn't actually going anywhere. Is that correct? It was just cyclic, that they view the world as cyclic. There was birth, death, generation after generation, but actually there was no change in any direction. Is that correct? Or?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
That's an interesting topic for a talk, so maybe we have to talk some more about that. But that's... that is interesting. This is the question of... Does time have a direction or not? And it's sometimes said that this is one of the differences between Western thought and Eastern thought, that Western thought tends to see things in terms of a linear development as a history that goes somewhere, whereas Eastern thought tends to see things in terms of cycles going round and round like the seasons and so on. And actually each of those, in a sense, each of those ways of conceiving time, and so remember this, that relates to what I was talking about before, that actually the only thing that we experience is the present moment. And the present moment has neither a linear evolution, nor does it have a cycle, right? It just is. So any idea that we have about a linear evolution or a cycle is just a concept. And so it's just a concept that we use to try to explain things in a way that makes sense to us as best as we can. And so sometimes this idea that there's this kind of linear, especially from the Hebrew tradition where you have the kind of the fairly short time frame and sort of a starting in one point and then moving on to what perhaps might be seen to be an ultimate destiny in the not too distant future. And that's a kind of an impression that you get from reading the Bible, which has kind of informed the Western tradition quite a lot, whereas the Eastern tradition sort of emphasizes this idea of the cycle. So, and then again, it's that was quite prominent in a colonialist discourse that in the West there was an idea of progress, which has been what has inspired the development of technology and science and society and so on, whereas the East is so kind of lazy, and the Asians, all they do is sit around, don't do anything all day because their energy is being sapped by this mind-numbing doctrine of the inevitability of fate and samsara and so on. So this has been a kind of a staple of colonialist discourse for a period of time, but obviously not a particularly edifying way of looking at the two things. But if you look at, of course, these ideas of cycles or linear progression as their abstractions, and in a sense they're abstractions from things that are meaningful observation. So if you look at, for example, birth, aging and death, yeah, we look at the story of one person's life, yeah, well, it starts in one place with a little baby. Little baby grows up, they get old, all kinds of stuff happens, and then they die. And so there's a linear, you know, starting in one place, developing, and then finishing. And so that's one of the huge, big paradigms that we learn about time from. And the other one, of course, is the seasons and the weather and so on, the cycles of day and night and so on, which tend to go round and round and round. You know, the seasons don't go in a direction, or at least not so that we can perceive. And they tend to repeat each other, the day and the night. So if you're looking at, if that's what you're looking at, you know, you're looking at the stars going around and round, and the seasons passing by, then you sort of get this idea of time as being a great cycle, being like a wheel of time, rather than being a linear projection. And of course, the two are not necessarily exclusive. Of course, you know, if you have a big enough circle and you take a section out of the circle, then it looks like a straight line. Yeah, and for all intents and purposes, it is a straight line. Yeah, and we know, according to the theory of relativity, that there actually is no really straight line, and that if you keep on traveling far enough, eventually it does become a circle. So these are the ideas of circles and lines. When you start to push them, begin to break down, and so there's no kind of absolute one or the other. So you have this discourse in Western society, especially since Darwin, of course, of evolution, and often is, you know, quite heavily misconstrued and has been used for all kinds of rather dubious social purposes and so on to look at the way that humans are, and to sort of become programmatic. And, you know, you have this idea of, you know, nature red in tooth and claw, and the idea that, you know, everything survives only because of conflict and violence and so on. It actually is not true at all. And if you look in nature, you see, well, there's both a lot of love and caring and compassion, and there's a lot of, you know, there's the violence and stuff is there as well. And both of them are equally essential. And my friend Guptila sent me some photos the other day which were very beautiful. It was by a wildlife photographer from Africa. And he'd taken some, he was out there shooting in the savannah or whatever, and there were these young cheetahs, and they chased this, I think it was, they call it an impala, is that right? An impala, it's like a small deer kind of thing. And so they chased this thing, and so you got the first photograph of these two cheetahs chasing this poor little impala, and you're thinking, oh my goodness, you know, what's going to happen next? And the next one, of course, they caught it, but actually they weren't really hungry, so they just played with it. And then the next thing you see, they're actually licking this impala and grooming it and playing together, and then you see the impala's licking and grooming the cheetahs back, you know, so they're having this whole kind of hug fest, you know. And it's quite astonishing, really. Yeah, you see, that's, you know, quite naturally happened, not because they're being trained or anything like that, but that's just spontaneous. It came from them. Of course, it'd be different if they were hungry, but, you know. So, yeah, nature provides you with both of these things. Yeah, there's the compassion, and, you know, one of the things which I've rather controversially said sometimes is that evolution is essentially compassionate. And the reason, because evolution actually makes it possible for beings to be here. Yeah, it's because of evolution that we can actually be here, that we can actually have food to eat, that we can actually have an ecosystem that supports us. And so this is what enables all of the wonderful life that is all around us. Yeah? So I don't see evolution as being a sort of a hard and kind of brutal process at all. And of course there is brutality in there, in nature. But it's really about promoting the flourishing of life. So you see in one sense, evolution, in a sense, from its own perspective, doesn't have really a direction. I mean, you know, there's just an organism of some kind which either survives or it doesn't, or it passes on its, you know, its genes to the next generation, or it doesn't. That's all, and so it doesn't have any kind of, doesn't reflect on itself in any kind of way. But on the other hand, there does seem to be this shift where, over time, the number of species increases, the level of complexity of them increases, and the ratio of brain to body increases. Yeah, so not for everyone, but for certain species. So these kinds of things. So there seems to be, in some sense, a kind of a direction. If that's a good thing, I don't know. Is it, I don't know if it's a good thing that we've got more brains now. But anyway, we do. So we have to deal with it. And so you could look at that and you can think, well, where are we going to go next? Yeah. So this is one of the big questions. Now that we've become very conscious of time, and very conscious of change. Of course, this is one of the great questions which our civilization keeps asking itself, is what's going to happen next? Yeah? What's going to be in the future? Yeah? And that's what, say, science fiction is. You know, when I was a teenager, I was a great science fiction geek. I used to read Asimov and all of those things, Star Wars and so on. And so that's the question. That's what all of those books are asking, is what's happening next? Yeah? Where are we going to go? So I think it's quite like, I think we're really the first generation, one of the first generations which has been so conscious of change in that way. And as Dana, you pointed out, that in the suttas and in the, I think mostly in traditional societies, that there's a kind of feeling that things have pretty much always been like this. You know, actually, in the suttas, they do talk about evolution. They don't talk about natural selection as such, but there is definitely an idea of evolution, change of society, and so on, which comes out in a few discourses, not many, but a few. But there are also many other stories which seem to sort of, you know, if you look at, say, Jataka stories, for example, you know, hundreds of Jataka stories, all of which sort of set in some mythic past, and all of which the mythic past is pretty much like India in 500 or 600 BC. Yeah, there's not that much cultural change in them. There are a few things, but not much. So it's funny that there seems to be this perception. People always have this perception that things are somehow getting worse. Yeah, the times are bad these days. You know, nobody's honest, and so on and so forth. And I used to believe that until I read that in the suttas as well, you know. This is 2,500 years ago, and they're saying the same thing. Oh, you know, previous generations, people were so much more honest, and, you know, it's hard to find somebody who's trustworthy these days. And then you start to think, hang on, maybe there's something more to it than that. You know, maybe whether things really are getting better or getting worse. I think things are getting better. Generally, and I think that people, by and large, have more wisdom and compassion than they did in previous generations. And I think that this comes about through things like education, communication, travel, seeing different people in different countries, being stimulated in new ways, having different ideas around. And I think we forget how narrow that our horizons were And there's something that was very clear to me when I was in Thailand, and I lived in the villages where you just in the, you know, these very simple villages, and it's a very idyllic kind of thing. I mean, Thailand's a beautiful country, and even though I was in Isan, it's the poor region of Thailand, but you know, it's not like grinding poverty. It's not, you know, it's not poverty in that sense. I mean, people don't have much stuff, but they're, you know, they've got enough to eat and they've got a house and they're okay. You know, they're reasonably well off. You have few possessions, and you know, I was very, very happy living there, and to live in the forest monasteries where you've even got less than the villagers do. So it wasn't a question of material development at all, but it's definitely a limitation of horizons. Yeah, there's, you know, people just didn't know very much, you know, and so some of these, you know, people, they still don't know, you know, is the world round, you know? Did one of the monks, monk of mine was a friend in a forest monastery, and one of the other monks came up and said, did they really send a man to the moon? Yeah?
It's a bit controversial.
Conspiracy theories aside. Oh, look, I love it. I love conspiracy theories myself. But so, you know, and then it was interesting to me to contemplate, you know, would I want to be like that? You know, I mean, in a sense, you say, yeah, it's a peaceful life, and it's, you know, it's quite idyllic in many ways. But from my point of view, no, I don't, actually. I don't want to be like that. I like having a knowledge about things. It's, you know, it's satisfying to be able to understand things and to have a more flexibility and a bigger context and broader picture of the world. So, you know, for me that was very interesting, because I could see, in a way, it's like stepping back in time to be able to look at that kind of village culture and be able to see directly how it is. And so this is why I do think that there is a progress, and I think that progress is very real and it's very important. And we can see that in our own lifetime, and we can see that here, right here in this room. And we take it so for granted that we can come together and do some meditation together. A generation ago in Australia, no one knew what meditation was, you know, much less to have so many places where you can go and study it and practice it. So I think there's actually, there is a positive evolution. And I think that positive evolution is actually happening fairly rapidly. Of course, the big question is, there's no guarantee, of course, that it's going to last, because as that positive evolution happens, then at the same time there's all the other stuff as well. There's also the resource depletion, there's also the climate change, there's also the extinction of species and the pollution and all of those other things. And there's no particular, you know, evolution doesn't offer any guarantees, so there's no divine destiny, yeah? So there's no guarantee that we're going to survive from one generation to the next, and one day we'll become extinct as a species. We don't know when that will be. It could be sooner rather than later. Species do become extinct quite suddenly in some cases. But, you know, humans are pretty resilient and pretty good at coping and adapting, so who knows what will happen. So I'm not a pessimist about things happening, but I do think that if we can survive and manage to get back in balance with our environments and all that, the world could move in a very positive direction. I actually have a lot of hope with that, and especially have a lot of hope with the intersection between East and West. And I think this is the, quite possibly, I think, to be honest, I think it's the most significant thing that's ever happened in the history of humanity, is the intersection of the East and the West and the coming together of these kind of two great streams of thought. Not just thought, but life and everything. And both of those traditions have a lot to offer to each other. And I think that the Western influence on Buddhism in particular, and in many other ways on Asian society, yes, of course, there are lots of terrible things, and there's lots of pollution, and there's lots of social breakdown and all of those things. So I don't want to minimize that or minimize the suffering of it at all. But at the same time, the Western influence has really revitalized, certainly from a Buddhist point of view, has really revitalized Buddhism in Asian countries to an extent that we really are rarely aware of. And we tend to imagine that if we go to Sri Lanka, for example, that we're seeing a form of Buddhism which is sort of, you know, passed down for more than 2,000 years and so on, which of course is true in some ways, but it's also true that Buddhism in Sri Lanka had become almost extinct a number of times, and after some of the persecutions and wars and so on, and that the forms of Buddhism that we see in Sri Lanka today owe as much to the reinvention under the colonial influence or reaction to the colonial influence than they do to actual any traditional practices that were done in Sri Lanka. And some of you may remember I spoke a little bit about one of the examples of this a little while ago about the pagoda to Maitreya Buddha on Balmoral Beach. Does anyone remember I talked about that a little while ago? Yeah, in the 1920s, I think it was, the Theosophical Society was very strong in Sydney, and they had a prophecy that the world teacher, who in some senses was said to be Jesus or Maitreya, would appear. And they actually built a pavilion, like a temple, called a Temple to the Sun or something like that, on Balmoral Beach. And Krishnamurti was, of course, supposed to be the one, that he declined the job offer. And so we actually went down there the other day. Sin Sin took us down for one of his famous coastal walks. And we searched around and to try to find it, and all that was left is a plaque. So if you go to Balmoral Beach, if you go to the beach, and if you look right to the left, there's a very large, ugly apartment block built in the 50s, and on the front of that apartment block is a little plaque, and it says this is the site where the temple was built. It was demolished in the 50s. And you can see why. I mean, if I was Maitreya, I'd want to reappear there. It's pretty beautiful. You're kind of looking out there, looking out over to the gap and everything, and it's got this whole Jesus walking on water kind of thing, you know. So I can see why that they thought it was there. And so that was, of course, under the influence of who was it? Not Colonel Olcott, Colonel Olcott's friends. I can't remember his name now. But one of the early members of the Theosophical Society, and of course they had been in Sri Lanka, and in many ways revitalized and reinvented the Buddhist tradition there, opening the first Buddhist schools and rehabilitating the study of Pali and giving in a sense the Sri Lankan culture its pride back in its own Buddhist traditions. So the Buddhism that we inherit is as much a product of modern times as it is a product of the ancient Buddhist traditions. It's a dialogue between those two, as it must be and as it should be. So when we come along and we engage with the Buddha's teachings, we're doing something that's, I think, extremely profound and extremely important. We shouldn't underestimate this. If we as humanity, if we fail, if we mess up our chance, then we've like really blown it big time. We don't know if we're going to get another chance. Yeah, we're basically using up all the oil. We're using up all the resources. And if we waste our opportunity, that's it. We might not get a second chance. And I think the key to that, the key to being able to actually surmount these challenges, is by an understanding of either Buddhism or the Eastern traditions generally. And I think that's what's going to save. If anything's going to save our planet, that's what's going to do it. And the basic reason for that is that the causes of conflict and suffering in the world, the inequality, the pollution, and all of these things, essentially come back to a loss of meaning. Is, I think, a huge part of it. A loss of meaning and a loss of perspective. And I think that we've become very empty inside. Not necessarily that we've become very empty inside. I think we've perhaps... It's difficult to say, difficult to quantify, but we've become more capable of distracting and gratifying ourselves by seeking externally. And so we have so much more choice today. We've got so much more money and so many more consumer goods and so on that we can purchase. That it's very easy for us to forget about those inner things that give our life meaning. And in fact, often we can substitute, so that the spending of money, the buying of unnecessary things, just wastage of all the things in our life. This is trying to fill some kind of hole or some kind of gap in our hearts. And that's why it's so relentless. It's because it's a continual trying to fill that gap. And it just doesn't actually get anywhere. You keep on pouring stuff in and it just keeps on getting swallowed up like a black hole. Because it doesn't answer that question of meaning. What's the purpose of our life? What are we actually doing here? What is it? What's our values? What's the value that gives meaning to our lives? And so because we are lacking that, then the consumerism and so on, and the technology, rather than being used for good, which of course it can be, and I mean it is to some degree, but it becomes squandered and wasted in the pursuit of things which are ultimately very ephemeral and very trivial. I was talking to Sister Yeshe about this the other day, and she, because she's been in India with the some of the poorest of the poor in India, the Dalits and stuff. She says they've all got mobile phones, you know. There's half a billion mobile phones in India. So you'll see people that are living just under a piece of plastic sheet with nothing except a mobile phone. That's all they've got. Somehow they managed to get it. Somehow they managed to pay for it and get it charged. That's the basic essential, you know. First of all, it's your mobile, then rice, dal. Terrible. So on the one hand, yes, you can see it's kind of crazy, but on the other hand, you know, it gives an opportunity to people. It enables them to communicate, enables people to get in touch and all of those kinds of things. So we shouldn't. Sorry?
They're very cheap.
They're very cheap, yeah. Yeah.
And an education to work.
Right. Exactly. So it opens up, you know, so many possibilities.
Some of the villages I was at in Nepal that didn't have electricity. They had one electric outlet in the entire village for the charging phone.
Right.
But even their entire community was arranged differently.
Mm-hmm.
That one outlet. Mm-hmm. Only to be used for mobile phone charging.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So this, I think, is the great challenge that as Buddhist practitioners that we have, is that I certainly don't think Buddhism is alone in this, but Buddhism, I think, has a very unique role to play. And I think the cause of the loss of meaning for me is pretty obvious, is basically that from a Western perspective, that very many of us just can't believe in God anymore. We've given up our old meaning. We just can't make ourselves believe in the things that we used to believe in, and so the religious practice becomes, in part, just a residue, a relic of something that once had meaning, I remember when I was, because I was brought up as a Catholic, I think the last time I went to Mass in Perth, I went along to the cathedral, probably was Christmas or something like that, with my mum and sister, I guess. And the overwhelming impression that I had was of sitting in this huge, beautiful cathedral, and you know, how few people there were. Like every third or fourth row, there'd be two or three people. And then when time came to sing the hymns, how embarrassing and sad it was, you know. And there's this glorious place, and there's wonderful organ playing, and beautiful music, and then people standing with their hymn sheets. So it just really encapsulated how the vitality had just left that tradition. So of course the vitality then goes into Hillsong and other things. So there's lots of vitality but not much spirituality, and various kinds of fundamentalism, which are obviously a reaction to modernity and a rejection of it rather than an understanding of it. So those kinds of things ultimately are self-defeating, because they're based on a rejection of knowledge, a rejection of understanding, and so they kind of hopefully will be victims of natural selection in the not too distant future. So in a sense, so our old gods are dead, yeah? Our old gods are dead, and they've been dying for such a long time. And this is something that I've learned from my study of mythology, is that I thought that the death of God, you know, when I was growing up, when I was like 15 and 16, I began to question my own beliefs. I thought that the death of God was a really radical, new, modern thing. And the more and more I began to look and read and study in ancient mythology, you realize that God has been dying ever since the very first stories that we have. The oldest stories in mythology are all stories about the death of God, all of them, in one way or another, about how God is receding, is vanishing, about how those in the previous generation were closer to God. Look at the Bible. What does the Bible start out with? In the beginning is God. Yeah? The very first part of the Bible. It's just God. There's only God and there's nothing else. Yeah? Then he creates the garden and Adam and Eve and stuff. So there's God and somebody else. Now God's only a visitor. Yeah? And actually the story is about Adam and Eve, and just God comes in. Then God kicks Adam and Eve out. Right? But the story is not about what happens to God after that. God's forgotten in the rest of the story. The story is about Adam and Eve and about their descendants. Yeah? God appears very rarely in the Bible, yeah, increasingly less rarely, less commonly. And then by the time you get to the New Testament, God can't even appear by himself. He sends down, well, we don't even know what he is, a proxy, yeah, his representative, yeah, second in command, and then he dies. Yeah, and so it's not even that the proxy is gone. Yeah, and so then you've got Paul, right, who didn't even meet Jesus; he only heard about him. Yeah, so you've got the Christianity is descended from the teachings of somebody who heard about a teacher who may or may not have been the Son of God. Yeah, and God himself is way out of the picture. So the Bible is the story of the death of God, how God has receded. And every mythology, if you go back even the older mythologies, in Gilgamesh, again, is the story of the death of God. It's like 2,000-3,000 BC. How far away it is to get in contact with the divine, and how difficult it is to believe in and to make sense of those things which in earlier times seemed so obvious and seemed so straightforward. And so this death of God has left us with that loss of meaning, and of course that's where Buddhism steps in, because Buddhism of course is the only world religion which has based itself right on that. It's taken as its most primary assumption that essentially God is irrelevant to the spiritual life. And when I say God, I'm not talking about the you know, the old man in the sky with a beard. Okay, that's kind of one way of thinking about him. But you know, the just that kind of way of thinking about things where we try to project the divine into some inexplicable, mysterious other. This is really what I'm talking about when I mean the God. And so Buddhism is, in a way, based on this idea that the spiritual life is about how we develop our own mind in the here and now. And I certainly don't think that that's unique to Buddhism. Many other people have come upon the same insight. I think it's fundamental to most of the Indian religions, and also found in the West as well. And a few weeks ago, when I was at my friend Giles' place, he showed me, I don't know if you've seen, if you try Googling Michelangelo and brain. Have you seen the painting of God and Adam on the Sistine Chapel? You know that it's actually organized in exactly the shape of a human brain, with all of the different organs and everything like that in place. Every detail in that fresco is exactly the anatomically perfect picture of the human brain. Yeah. So this is obviously what Michelangelo was modeling that painting on. Yeah. So for him, his hidden message there, God is the brain. Yeah. So God is our own mind. So this is not for Buddhism and Buddhists. This is not an abstruse thing. It's not something we struggle with. It's the very foundation of our spiritual path, is that actually we have to practice with what we have here. What is here and now? What is real? What is our experience? What is actually present in this moment? And this is the stuff of our practice, and not some kind of abstract and rarefied ideal of something somewhere else. What is actually present and real here and now? And that's all we have to do. So if we look at, you know, questions like evolution and so on, you know, we can speculate. We don't really know what will happen in the future. We can speculate about what might happen. And there's nothing wrong with doing that, as long as that we understand that that's all it is. It's just speculation. But whatever happens in the future, it will all happen because of what the choices are that we make in the present moment. What choices do we make every moment in the present moment? These are what make up time. So if humanity is to survive, and if we're to flourish, and if we're to prosper both spiritually as well as materially, then this is up to each of us, is to make those choices in the present moment. What are the values by which we wish to live our life? What are those qualities that we believe make life worth living? What are those things that give meaning to our life? And how can we live in a way that's in accord with that meaning? So these are the questions which are so important for us all to contemplate, to remember. Not to let our life go past. Not to get, you know, turn around at the end of our life and look back and think, what a waste. What did I spend my time doing? Yeah. But to actually realize, what is real? What is meaningful? What is true? What is good? What is the very best way that I can spend my very limited time here on this very precious planet? Because we don't know what's going to happen. And if we don't live our life well here and now, who knows what tomorrow will bring? For both ourselves personally, we only have a short time. Yeah? And for us as a human species, we don't know. Maybe there's a glorious future for us. Yeah? Maybe Asimov was right. We're going to go out to the stars and make a global galactic empire. Yeah? Fantastic. Yeah? Or maybe not, yeah? Maybe Philip K. Dick was right and they're going to turn into a horrible thing. We don't know. So this is why it's so important to make those right choices in the present moment. So there's some reflections for you this evening on evolution and time. And so I offer that for your reflection. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments and questions.
The Mahayana idea of bodhisattva replaces the human need for someone be greater than us, you know, when we have difficulties.
Uh-huh.
And it's always like when you look at the child crowds and others.
Mm-hmm.
So when people go through great suffering, that there is some need, and they realize their limitations, there is just some heart need, that there is a hope that there is someone greater who will protect us and guide us even at death, you know, because death is so uncertain. So I feel that the ideal of bodhisattva, someone merciful, you know, compassionate, it sort of fills that human need too. What do you think? That's what I feel.
I actually had the same thought this morning.
So wishing for a bodhisattva to come.
No, I was just thinking about how the relationship of a child to a parent draws you forward. As a child, there's a sense that there's an other that can help you.
I'm not.
That's why we're fighting
too. No, I neither want to be saved nor to save.
What are you thinking, Sam?
I was just thinking along the lines of like particular Mahayana practices and the emergence of them, and more so relating them to my own experience and sometimes my desire to, when things get a bit hard, you know, wanting to recite a mantra or like invoke, you know, something from a bodhisattva as a protective sort of means. But I think for me it was based on less about belief and more about some type of security. You know, like and maybe it is, you know, part of the human condition to an extent, you know, when things get too hard we wanna get some type of outward help, you know. That's sort of along the lines of what I was thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. So in Buddhism there is many gods. The only thing that, I mean, my understanding is and stuff is the creator god is the one in the bin, but you know, there's hundreds of gods, especially in say go to Thailand. There's god for every day of the week, I mean it's every hundred, you know, everything and stuff. So it's fine, I mean go pray your heart out if you want to, there's thousands of gods. But just creator god is the only kind of no go, it's from what I understand anyway.
Right. And that's exactly what the death of God is about. Because there's so many gods that none of them actually matter anymore.
Okay.
Yeah, you can allow anybody to believe in, yeah, if you want to believe in this god or that god or whatever, so what? At the end of the day, yeah? So that's why Buddhism is actually very tolerant about all of these beliefs, and when it went into new countries and so on. Of course, there's this, you know, vast array of gods in Indian culture, and then when it goes to every new culture, then there's new ones, and constantly old ones drop out and new ones and so on. So... But from Buddhist point of view, it's like, yeah, whatever, yeah, so what, you know? And so it's that very attitude of, you know, whatever God you want to worship is fine, but it doesn't matter so much in the end. That itself is saying that it's actually not the God which is so important, which is so essential. And so actually Buddhism has always been, it's always a long way, its very starting point is a long way down that notion of the death of God. And if you look at the way that the gods are treated in Buddhist mythology, they're treated in a very kind of playful fashion, you know, where the gods of Hindu mythology and the older mythology were very kind of serious and very quite terrifying in some respects and very awe-inspiring. And by the time they get to the Buddhist things, they become more playful, much more kind of, there's much more kind of a sense of lightness, a sense of fun about it.
But from the question that was being put to you before was to do with, you know, that kind of... And from what I understand, I'm assuming you guys have an enormous faith in your practice. Like when I hear people speak, especially when I ask some stuff, David, you know, an unshakable faith in their practice. You know, to the point where you know, you might not get food, or you don't have food, or you know, you wait and you know, you don't break. You don't go out there and use money if you need to or whatever. You know, you don't do that. You have an unshakable faith in your practice and stuff. So I'm assuming that is your kind of protective mechanism against, you know, as I said, people like us that kind of really, you know, have this kind of striving towards some type of easier or some type of kind of, you know, break, you know, or something out there that's going to kind of cut us some slack.
Aren't we the ones that are supposed to give ourselves a break? Because you can't ask for anyone else. When you talked about eating religion being the thing that you thought would save Earth and humanity, if it's been going for so long, what would give you so much faith in it? I'm actually a very optimistic person. I always think that but you know, that line of thought has been around for such a long time, as in nothing. And if people haven't been able to put it into practice uniformly across cultures in that amount of time, what would make you think that they would be able to see light, you know?
Well, I wasn't quite saying that. I don't think that it's the case that it hasn't been able to be put in practice. I think it has. Buddhist influence in Asian culture has been tremendous and has had a huge positive impact and sustained civilization for hundreds of years across huge areas.
But look at the Earth, like what you were saying, you know, the consumerism in Asia is probably worse than anywhere. Like the desire for it is so intense, you know.
Sure, yeah. So I'm not trying to minimise the problems, but the I mean, from my experience, for example, in Thailand, is my main experience in Asia. Well, Thailand and Malaysia. There's an actual problem, right? So the actual problem is like, that there is this kind of desire, this materialism, and then that causes social fracture and it causes pollution and so on and so forth. So, well, you either just let the problem continue or you try to find something that might be able to help it. And then if you look at what actually does help it and what helps people to not go in that, then that's something which practically does actually help, is giving people some sense of spiritual meaning in their life. Yeah?
But is it superficial? Because, you know, people go to temple and ask, okay, I go to temple, I'm going to go and buy, all this stuff, you know? Does it really... I'm a bit cynical about the way it manifests, and I've seen the really good side of the influence of Buddhism, obviously, otherwise it wouldn't be around. But at the same time, when I've experienced those cultures, the gap between the spiritual core of the culture and the practice in, you know, capitalism or whatever, is pretty full on. And it makes you wonder, how much time, it's how much time do you need, for the bell to keep ringing,
Sorry, the lady behind you had a question.
My question is about what you were saying about using your life to lead a good life.
Yeah.
On an individual basis, how do each of us know what is the right thing to do to lead a good life? And where my question really is coming from is, you recently told a story about an elephant.
Uh-huh.
A river and a pussy cat.
Okay, yeah.
A river.
Yeah.
I view myself as a baby kitten.
Uh-huh.
And I would like to be able to do good and help people.
Uh-huh.
But I don't have a lot of this life left.
Yeah.
And I don't have the time to become an elephant.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering, how do you... I
as a kitten, can I like just jump in and try and learn on the job?
Uh-huh.
How do you know when you're helping and when you're harming?
A kitten.
Where does the wisdom come from?
A kitten looks like an elephant if you're an ant. Yeah? So help the ant. Yeah, that's all. If you can help, yeah, whatever you can help in front of you at any time, then just do what you can to do that. Yeah. So this is why I like to think in kind of big terms, you know, and we're sort of talking about some very big topics in the talk tonight. But in terms of actually living and so on, I mean, those people who live with me in the monastery and that will know that I'm very frustrating because I never kind of plan anything. I just kind of do things. And I don't think about it very much, you know. I mean, like when we started our monastery, I just could have ended up there, and, oh, it's a place, and okay, we'll do this, you know. And I've done a lot of things, and I never really thought about it very much, you know. Like, I've written big, complicated books, and I never kind of sit and think, now I've got to plan this book. I just sort of start writing, you know. We've done a lot of things, but it's always just, for me, it's always just what's there in front of you, and how can I respond in a positive way the best I can to that. Yeah.
The other part of your question was how you know.
I guess the thought of becoming an elephant, I find it something that's just not achievable for me. It's kind of making me want to stop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are things in front of me, but I'm thinking I should stop. I'm not an elephant. I'm just a kitten. I'm not explaining it very well, but and I hear what you're saying about looking in front of you.
Mm.
Yeah.
But
I want to go in search a wee bit. I don't want to just look.
Well, that's what kittens do, don't they? They stumble around exploring the place where they're living, the environment. Yeah.
Caution. Yeah. But adventurous.
Oh, no.
I really said something about how do you know whether what you do doing good is
doing good. I do know you're not
covering. Hmm. It is.
It is.
Yeah.
Sorry? That doesn't agree in terms of grammar. How do you know that the good you think you're doing is not causing harm? And your answer was it is.
Hmm. No. Well, you know, of course, you know, well, it does cause harm. Everything causes harm. As long as you're in samsara, everything causes harm, so you can't worry about that too much. But you have to trust your wisdom. Just keep on reflecting, keep on investigating, check things out, review them. You know, after something's done, look back, think, was that useful? Did that accomplish what it was supposed to set out to do? Ask other people's advice and opinions, all of those just kind of ordinary things. And at the end of the day, just trust yourself and make a decision. Yeah, that's all we can do. But the good decisions, you know, trust when your mind is clear. Don't base a decision on fear. Base it on, you know, when the mind is very clear, when you do some meditation, and then what you know to be the right thing to do.
But like you said, Bhante, you can't always come from the meditation. You said you act on the moment.
Mm.
That's not necessarily always after pondering.
No, that's true. Yeah.
I know sometimes people can, you know, can procrastinate due to pondering.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And not achieve anything.
Yeah.
I had a query talking back to the point. I thought, like, I understand the Buddhism's main
aim is not anything to do with focusing too much on God. But I think with regard to that, it sounds like it's almost about studies of interest to try and live in a way that's closer to I mean, the third thing with Brahma Viharas, right? So try and develop those. Which again is, you were saying, it's all very hard. And that whole thing about just trying to, in your day-to-day life, and you're on a bus and it's raining and there's not really that much but just to develop those mind states that are a bit more sort of related or those four things. I don't know. My question is, is that something that people should like, how do you do that to just keep every time it comes to your mind, say, okay, well, I should try and be more positive or try and develop some of those mind states? It's all, even the economy is something that's so hard to understand.
I was wondering if sometimes the ideals of Buddhism and being a lamp unto ourselves is sometimes or often an exception rather than the rule. And my example that came to mind was taking maybe Thailand for an example, or a traditional Buddhist society, you find that the laity, the idea is generating merit, and the prayers are chanting, transferring merit to the deceased.
Mm.
That there's this supernatural sort of force, this field of merit that people see as a means of protection.
Mm.
So in a sense, like their idea of karma, and merit takes on this almost godly sense in a way that's their sort of otherworldly protection.
Mm.
So it seems to be like a contradiction of being a lamp unto themselves, and the monastics who practice well, who lead such an example, do sort of exemplify that. But I think on the other hand, the whole construction of and the way it's sort of set up in traditional societies does take on a very almost religious protective sort of stance, position. And I guess it's sort of thinking that until we can sort of get to a certain maybe stage in our practice or awareness of the Dharma, that do you think that the sort of humanity, has that longing or that desire to sort of look for another means of getting help rather than laying the hard yards for themselves?
Yeah, of course. Of course. It's always a tendency.
Yeah.